This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the intellectual panic room where, buffeted by claims and counterclaims, you and I can quietly and calmly get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, as we slowly ease out of lockdown, what damage has the pandemic done to the economy and what sort of recovery can we expect?
The government is now paying the wages of about a quarter of workers in the UK. Separately, the Department of Work and Pensions says it's received 1.8 million new claims for universal credit.
Virgin Atlantic says it plans to cut more than 3,000 jobs and stop flying from London Gatwick.
The British engineering company Rolls-Royce could shed up to 8,000 posts. The firm described the impact of the crisis engulfing the air industry as unprecedented.
New car sales collapsed by 97% in April, the lowest monthly figure since 1946.
It's bad. We knew that. But how much better will it get and how quickly? This week, the Bank of England drew up scenarios anticipating a shrinking of the economy by 14% this year, based on most of the lockdown being eased over the summer. The biggest decline since before records began. After that, the bank's scenarios have UK growth rebounding by up to 15% next year. So today, I want to understand what that recovery might look like and what we can expect from our economy in the long run. Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. At the end of March, the government put large swathes of the economy onto life support. So first, let's analyse what the government has done to prop up businesses and citizens. Faisal Islam is the BBC's economics editor. Faisal, let's start with the basics. What support is the government offering to individuals and business?
Well, there's a whole range of fairly unprecedented supports. The biggest single support is the Coronavirus Jobs Retention Scheme, the furlough scheme, that essentially puts into standby mode millions of workers for a period of 2 to 3 months with their wages paid for up to £2,500, 80% of their wages. Then there's a series of grants for small business. There are delays to the payment of taxes, whether that's VAT or business rates. There are, in conjunction with the Bank of England, a series of supports for lending. and they operate slightly differently depending on the size of the company. Supergiant multinationals that operate in corporate borrowing markets, bond markets, they get support from the Bank of England and are getting the interest rate they pay on those debts essentially coming down. But it's all the way down to very small companies who are getting 100% of their loans guaranteed by government and those loans turned around quite quickly. But these are debts, these are extra borrowing, and at some point, even at subsidised interest rates, have to be paid back. And in other countries, we have seen more direct, just sort of cash handouts, grants being pumped in to companies. Here, it's mainly, they're not exclusively done through borrowing.
So if there is a big difference between us and other countries, it is the difference between offering loans and offering direct cash bailouts. Faisal, how much is all this costing?
We don't know exactly how much it's going to cost, but we think, you know, the jobs retention scheme, for example, tens of billions, 40 billion, around 10 billion for the self-employment scheme. And you can start to sort of add that up. And the direct fiscal cost of this is probably going to be more than for the financial crisis. And indeed, the indirect cost. So there'll be far less tax being paid given the state of the economy. We know that there's 1.8 million claims for universal credit. That's off the scale. That's going to cost a lot of money per month. You can't put a single price tag on it at the moment, but let me give you a couple of examples here. You know, the public borrowing around the time of the financial crisis, you know, leaped above 100 billion and we thought this would never happen again. Just in March at the budget, the government anticipated over the next 4 years, it would be borrowing 240 billion. What has transpired in just a few weeks since then is it will be borrowing £220 billion from the markets in just 4 months, not 4 years. And that, I think, is probably our best proxy for the sorts of price tag that you're asking for. I think that there is a question about affordability. At the beginning of this process, the suggestion from government was we can't afford not to do this. But now I think there are some worries that employers are a little bit too accustomed to this type of support. These sorts of schemes, though, they get created in crisis. It wouldn't be absurd for a scheme like the furlough scheme to be around in some form permanently. That's what happens in Germany. It's called the Kurzarbeit scheme. It was tremendously successful during the great financial crisis. It saved 1 million jobs. So you do get in crisis policy innovation that then sticks around the government. Now they're also just shying away, I think, from providing funding for business models that will fundamentally have to change too. And I think aviation would be the biggest example of that. The number of flights is going to be greatly depressed for some time to come. And therefore, you are seeing governments limiting their funding.
So in some respects, they're moving from a strategy based on a belief in a temporary, although significant, depression in trade, to the possibility that some things will be affected much longer term, and they're trying to build that into the way in which they're doing the funding.
I don't think we're getting that explicitly, but yes, it creates some really difficult dilemmas for government. It's a lot easier going in to the problem, opening the checkbook, telling everybody they have access to the same bailouts and rescue schemes. It is far more difficult coming out of here when you may have to do different things in different sectors, where you may prolong the rescue schemes. That is a far more difficult task to balance for any government in normal times, and these are far from normal times.
Faisal Islam. Now let's take a more detailed look at one sector which has been particularly badly hit as a result of the lockdown and maybe the last return to anything approaching normality. Hospitality. Kate Nichols is Chief Executive of Hospitality UK. Kate Nichols, can you give me an idea of the sort of companies that exist in the hospitality sector?
You're talking about 200,000 small businesses that go from an independent single site right the way through to the largest national chains and international chains. And it covers everything from coffee shops and cafes, restaurants, pubs, bars, hotels, accommodation providers, holiday parks, contract caterers, tourist attractions. It's a huge industry. It's £130 billion turnover, so it's bigger than aerospace, automotive, and pharmaceuticals put together.
Wow.
And it's the third largest employer in the country with 3.2 million people working in the sector.
Now, what percentage of companies have closed entirely during the lockdown?
Almost 75% of companies in hospitality have closed in their entirety. 84% of our workforce has been successfully furloughed, so that's 2.5 million people. Sadly, we had about 250,000, 300,000 people who were not able to be furloughed because of the way the scheme operated. And a similar proportion, again, were people who were seasonal workers who would have been just at the point of being taken on for their summer season who have not been employed.
Okay, now let's talk about reopening. Have you any sense of when and how reopening is likely to happen and affect your sector?
I don't think anybody's got a sense of when. So I think for the hospitality sector, it's the how lockdown is lifted that is the critical point to bear in mind.
Right.
So we did some research with our members that suggested that with social distancing in place, they would open at 30 to 40% of their normal revenues. All of these businesses rely on a high volume of people passing through because they've got incredibly low margins of somewhere between 4 and 8%. And so therefore, you need to have 60% of your revenues coming through before you start to make a profit. So we're needing to have some government support to allow an opening that is at a loss.
So in other words, you're worried that the support available during the lockdown will be so quickly removed that actually people won't survive the period afterwards.
Absolutely. And because we're such a big part of the economy locally and nationally, if we don't, then it will have ripple effects throughout the whole of our supply chain. And so the economic impact will be far greater.
Now, I imagine there's some very interesting discussions going on within the sector about how to innovate in order to create new socially distanced ventures whilst not losing such a high proportion of customer throughput.
You know, people are looking creatively at technology-led solutions for customer ordering and customer payments, so you minimise contact points. So you have to pre-book your table. You might want to prepay so that you don't have that contact with the till at the end of the session, because that's one of the frequent touch points that people are concerned about with infection. I think there will be undoubtedly more at-table ordering via apps. All of those things to try and make customers feel a little bit more confident and minimising the contact with the waiters. And if you look at Estonia, Tallinn and Lithuania, they are looking at deregulating the whole of the outdoor space in their capitals and turning it over to outdoor alfresco eating. Now, I'm not sure what the English weather would think about that, and it might limit what people can do, but it certainly would help, because we know that outside areas are intrinsically easier to manage infections in. So I think we could encourage a temporary deregulation over the summer of outside spaces, tables and chairs, and encouraging more people to be outside. So I think there's something local authorities could do there and central government could do to encourage that. The focus is entirely on coronavirus at the moment, and therefore to be able to look at some of those creative solutions about how you can think of a way forward, it makes a change from dealing with the day-to-day crisis management of how do you save jobs, how do you get through, which is relentlessly negative, to be able to look at that longer time distance horizon and think about how we could innovate and develop and respond positively is really interesting.
However this goes, at the end of that process, do you think a different kind of hospitality sector will emerge?
Undoubtedly. I think it will be leaner. We aren't going to be able to save all the sites, even if we manage to save all the companies. You know, we are inevitably, as we look at reopening, engineering out certain jobs and roles in our sector that we've previously thought were essential. The meet and greet, the taking in orders, and if we're moving towards a more automated process, inevitably that won't come back in full.
Kate Nichols. So how should lockdown be eased and support withdrawn? Harvard professor Jeffrey Frankel served on the US President's Council of Economic Advisers in the mid-80s and again in the late 90s. He's been looking at lessons from history. Professor Frankel, early on in the lockdown, economists talked of a V-shaped recovery when we come out of it. What is a V-shaped recovery?
Well, it's pretty much what it sounds like, that if you look at the path of GDP or some other measure of economic activity, it goes down sharply, but then bounces back equally sharply. If you look at historical precedents, when there is a natural disaster like a hurricane or an earthquake, even the previous examples of pandemics had this nature. For example, in 2003, the SARS virus, China's GDP fell sharply, but then they bounced back. So I don't think it was so unreasonable that back in, let's say, February, that this was a reasonable forecast.
Do you think it's still reasonable?
No, I don't.
So what would you predict the shape of the graph to look like as we begin to come out of the pandemic?
I would say a U-shaped recovery is the best that we would hope for, where we return to normalcy only very gradually, and perhaps not fully reattaining economic health until we have a vaccine, which we're told will take a year or more.
What do you think that people who are making policy should worry about most as they try and engineer that situation?
My concern is that the authorities in some places will withdraw the public health measures too early, reopen business too early, and also that they will withdraw macroeconomic stimulus measures too soon. And either one of those things could send us back into a second wave of contagion and a second downturn in the economy to produce a so-called W-shaped recession. For historic precedents, we have to go back a long ways. The global influenza pandemic of 1918-19, and then there were three waves. In the United States, I've seen some research on what different cities did. Some of them went all out for wearing masks and shutting down the schools and public events, and some of them kept them on for longer, and that helps explain which cities suffered a big relapse. My hometown originally happens to be San Francisco, and it is this example of this, that early on they did the most aggressive public health measures, and they worked quite well. And then in November 1918, they said all clear, because the infection rate and the death rate had come down partway, and they got hit by the third wave, and they ended up being one of the worst hit cities.
Now, a lot of governments are supporting their economies during the lockdown with just enormous financial packages. Are there any significant lessons about what government should continue to do and what government should stop doing when it comes to helping people directly?
I would mention 1937, in the case of the US at least, as an example of premature withdrawal of fiscal stimulus. President Franklin Roosevelt thought that with some reason that the economy had recovered substantially from the Great Depression, and his Treasury decided to go for a balanced budget. They cut spending, they raised taxes, and that sent us right back into what turned out to be a pretty bad relapse. So I think that's another mistake we should avoid this time.
Look, we've been told over the years that to have such a high level of debt and to increase the level of debt is going to create big problems in the future, and it's unsustainable. What's your view of that?
This is an open question. For one thing, one has to make a distinction between what country you're talking about. There's broadly three categories of countries. There's countries that, mainly the United States, that seem to be able to borrow an unlimited amount. I guess we don't have to worry about how big the debt gets for the foreseeable future. And on the other extreme, the developing countries that definitely do have to worry about it. And then in between are countries like European countries, where maybe 20 years ago we thought they were pretty safe and they could borrow at rock bottom interest rates. But we learned that that wasn't the case in the euro crisis of 2010.
At the heart of what you're saying is an obvious dilemma. You said, we've got to continue with the policy and not turn off the taps essentially too early, because in that case, we might help spark a W-shaped recession or waves of recession, and that's really not good. On the other hand, you've also pointed out whether or not maintaining the funding to stop that from happening is actually sustainable in the longer term. How do we reconcile those problems?
Well, you're quite right. Those are very much at odds. I will say it is especially acute for the developing countries. There, I think we're going to have to see some write-downs. For Europe, it's walking a very fine line. I think there are countries that came into this with plenty of fiscal space. Germany comes to mind. There are others that are more like the developing countries in the southern part of Europe. You know, for Britain, real interest rates, I think, have been pretty low. And so maybe you can't afford substantial deficits for a while. I think, given the stakes, that it's probably worth the gamble.
Professor Jeffrey Frankel. Finally, I want to know what our recovery might look like, and also whether the pandemic will have effected any lasting economic change. Stephanie Flanders is head of Bloomberg Economics, and Professor Jagjit Chadha is director of the National Institute of Economic and Social Research. Stephanie and Jagjit, we've just been hearing Professor Frankel saying that
he anticipates U-shaped recoveries for many countries, and also that if the right things are not done, it could be a recurrent W-shaped recovery. So, Stephanie, what's your expectation of what a recovery is going to look like?
Well, I think two big things have happened as we've thought through and seen the impact of this right from the start when we first started seeing it in China. One is obviously that the depth of the hit to the economy has been progressively revised up as we've seen what an effect this lockdown has on economies.
Jagjit, is that how you see it?
It's very hard to understand where the economy might go. And one reason that's amplified is that we have tremendously broad, wide-ranging trade links with the rest of the world. Every country in the traded world is going through some form of lockdown. That means we can't expand domestic demand by trading with those economies either. And that is almost doubling the size of the domestic shock. And so when we think about coming out of lockdown, unless it's synchronized, unless all countries come out at the same time, there will still be things holding back activity in every economy as other economies go in and out of various forms of lockdown. And that's why, even if it is just about conceivable we might have a V-shaped recovery, it's more likely that it will be much more shallow and there will be repetitions as the virus returns, or worse still, mutations as the virus returns.
Okay, that's very interesting. The best case scenario is there's no recurrence of the virus in any significant way. There is good levels of confidence from consumers and other people in the economy, and that we act with a degree of synchronicity. How would we measure what would happen under the best case scenario and what would happen under the worst case scenario? Stephanie.
Well, I think, I mean, we've seen in a sense what happens under the worst case because we have a continuation or repeat of the cataclysmic decline in the economy that we've already seen. I mean, these are numbers that we just don't normally have in any kind of calculation of recessions or any recession that any of us can remember, to have the economy falling by a third in the last few months. But obviously, if this is drawn out, if large chunks of industry actually go out of business despite the best efforts of the government, you know, that we know has lasting effects on the economy. Even when you get back, you've lost companies that would have been solvent, would have been able to make a go of things, or consumers just changing their behavior in a kind of semi-permanent way. I think those are the things you worry about in terms of permanent damage.
How do you deal with that? Stephanie, you've been looking at how they've done it in China.
Yes, I've got colleagues who actually went into Wuhan. The Bloomberg bureau chief in Beijing went to Wuhan with a few reporters for the 10 days where they reopened. And it was very striking. At the beginning of the time, obviously, there's no traffic in the streets. Everything was locked down. When it came to the production side of the economy, if you like, the supply side, workers going to factories, within 10 days, you had very high numbers on the streets and maybe 90-95% of people back in their factories, but still shops, restaurants, all open but empty. It may be a short-term thing where people are actually just worried about being forced into quarantine rather than inherently scared of consuming. But, you know, there is this lurking worry that once you find out what life's like without all these consumer goods or consumer activities or without going to restaurants, will people immediately go back to going to restaurants as much as they did before, when if they haven't had a big hit to their income, they may have found that they're able to do without going to restaurants as much as they did before? So there's the kind of behavioural change just from having seen, if you like, a different kind of life.
And Jagjit, workers can be quite scared of going back to work, and we've already seen something of an argument between the TUC and the government on the question of the conditions under which workers are expected to resume.
Yes, I do hope the discussions arrive at the right settlement where industries that need workers can work in a way to guard their safety, but also start producing. At the more aggregate level, the interesting thing that we're going to see this year is that households will save. In a sense, there'll be some forced savings because they can't go out to spend on the things that Stephanie was talking about. We're actually going to save more as an economy than we have for a very long time. And so going ahead, what we need to think of is this also an opportunity to rebalance the economy. Could be argued that over the last few decades, we've had far too much consumption, too little investment in the economy. And as a result, we've tended to borrow on the margin from abroad. And so that if in this process, with more requirements to build up domestic savings, and if we can get firms to invest a little bit more, that will lead to a better outcome in the economy. What the government has to think about is those kinds of activities that can be implemented as lockdowns ease a little bit, which could involve construction, maybe the development of social housing or other activities that the government can get involved in quickly, those that help the economy now, but also help other sectors by providing income and jobs that then get spent elsewhere in the economy. We can also encourage the redistribution of workers to the areas in which we do need workers, which would be agriculture, potentially construction, and even with some training that could be arranged, which itself would provide some jobs in the area of social care and others.
Clearly, trying to redeploy that labour into areas that are valuable for the economy and are fit for those skills would be a very good start, and potentially with the government being involved in that training.
So that's a process that could be started to offset some of the scarring. And one thing we're seeing as well is that the extent of new firm births, which is one way to think about the dynamism of the economy, as we would expect, is completely stalled. And so we need to think also about how to encourage new firms to start when and if parts of the lockdown start to ease.
It's very interesting. Both of you have put a lot of emphasis on the role of government in essentially things that we have in the last 30 years left up to the private sector, and said that it's best not to get involved. And in fact, at one stage when Jagjit was speaking, I was thinking, well, we could rename this the five-year plan, because it does kind of suggest a very high level of intervention in helping guide industry and guide workers to the sectors that you think would lead the recovery. Do either of you see that as a problem? Jagjit?
You're right. I mean, we've gone through a period in turning to the market for solutions. But what we've been hit by with this terrible pandemic is a natural disaster, one which individuals, firms cannot have insured themselves against in any proper way. And in that sense, the government has a responsibility to provide the kind of insurance it is doing. The government is also in a position to aid the recovery, helping where it can, the redirection of labour and capital towards the new areas that will spring up over time. I don't think it's a five-year plan. It's responsible government.
Stephanie?
The gig workers, we'd had lots of discussion around how to put them in a stronger position in the workforce. I think those kind of debates about a new sort of contract between employers and employees in those sectors, I think we will have that conversation, along with all of the other things that we've heard people talk about paying key workers better and nurses, I think will be something we'll look at.
But this is very interesting. Looked at very coldly from the outside, the proposition seems to be that we will emerge from this wanting to treat a whole lot of people very much better, in a circumstance where you all agree that we'll have significantly less wealth, at least in the short and medium term. Now, I'm bound to ask, how do you accomplish that trick?
So I think there's two things going on. There's a reassessment by investors globally of what kind of amount of debt a government can hold for it to be still sort of solvent and worth investing in. You know, that number used to be lower. You know, the debt is equivalent to 70 or 80% of the whole economy. Everybody's numbers is going to go up as a result of this by maybe 20 or 30 percentage points. And I think that will reset the yardstick, because in a sense, there's nowhere for investors to go. As Jagjit has said, every country is facing the same thing, and they're all going to see a big increase in debt. But the second thing is, if we've not only added, say, 20 or 30 percentage points to our debt, but it's still going up year after year, even though the pandemic is quite far behind us, investors might start to question then whether they want to buy government debt from the UK versus other countries. But that's when it becomes important, this key thing that was also important in the global financial crisis, is do we have control over our own currency? Can we, at the limit, print the money in order to be able to raise that debt? And the truth is, we do still, just as the US does. That is not the case for the individual members of the Eurozone. And that is why we always keep coming back to, can the Eurozone survive and will it have another crisis?
One of the things that's interesting in what's happened in the last few days is that the government message seems to have turned 180 degrees. We heard that we are going incredibly rapidly from stay at home to, as one or two of the newspapers have put it, hurrah, freedom beckons. What worries would you have, Stephanie, about how you manage that process?
You have to worry a bit. It makes me nervous if we're trying to quickly turn on and off restrictions and indeed kind of consumer psychology, because we want to give people confidence, and they don't necessarily get confidence from dramatic changes in the messaging from government.
Stephanie Flounders there with Professor Jagjit Chadha. And my conclusion is, bumpy times ahead and cool minds needed, open to new thoughts. My thanks to Faisal Islam, Kate Nichols, Jeffrey Frankel, Jagjit Chadha and Stephanie Flounders. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Luke Radcliffe, Sally Abrahams and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, and if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including the inequalities of lockdown, the psychological impact of the pandemic, easing the lockdown, the care sector and COVID, and coronavirus from testing to vaccine. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.